Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, and innovation is the key word with our guest today. Jackie Kazel is an innovation specialist at the General Services Administration's 18F office. Before that, she was a Presidential Innovation Fellow and a visiting instructor at the University of Missouri. Welcome, Jackie.
It's nice to be here.
It's nice to meet you. Well, firstly, when I said General Services Administration's 18F, we should probably talk about what that is.
Sure.
Just sort of define what that office is.
Sure. So that's my current role in my career. 18F is a arm of the, it's a component of the GSA that's sort of like a tech shop in government.
Okay.
So they do projects for other government agencies.
Oh, okay, cool. I just wanted to sort of define that. I throw that out there. You know, with my job, I kind of am aware of what that office is, but, you know, people listening to this might know, 18F, what's that? So we met at the PBS Media Shift's recent Collab Space event in D.C. where you were talking about open data. So let me ask you the really obnoxious question. What does it feel like to have innovation in your job title?
So I'm going to go back a little bit to when I was at the Washington Post.
Okay.
And the Washington Post created these positions called innovation editors. And I remember when the positions were created because I thought to myself, and please forgive me to my ex-coworkers, I thought to myself, what is this title, innovation editor, and how does it give you some sort of license to innovate?
It's sort of a blank check of undefined means of undefined purposes.
Exactly, but it was almost like you can innovate and you cannot.
Right. Oh no, no, that's your job description. It has nothing to do with innovation. You just follow orders. But these people over here are innovators.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I went on, you know, a couple years later, last year I had the title of Presidential Innovation Fellow.
Right.
And when I was serving in that position, a couple of ex-colleagues of mine had said to me, Jackie, innovation fellow? Really?
Yes.
The person who had mocked the innovation editor title? And it feels a little bit like that. You know, it shouldn't be, the title shouldn't be like an authority to, I am not an authority to innovate. To, you know, everybody should be doing it.
Right. Yeah, that should be part of everybody's job description.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. That is a title that will go away. And it will turn possibly into maybe they'll probably always be like a research or labs component to places, mm-hmm. like how can we test the boundaries? But the idea of sort of innovating in the way that we are is going to be an everyday thing.
Well, let's sort of back up away from the programming, because you actually came to become a programmer out of photojournalism. You started out as a photographer. Can you sort of talk about how you got from there to here?
Sure. So I actually started out in advertising and studio photography, and then I wanted to get into journalism, which is how I made the transfer to the University of Missouri. Mm-hmm. And when I got my bachelor's, I applied for 40 jobs, got 3 callbacks, 2 interviews, and 1 offer in South Florida at the Sun Sentinel, working at their Latin arm, El Sentinel. And when I was working down there, I did a story about a woman who tried to file for political asylum through the proper channels and was denied. And so she was being deported. And it just so happened to be my last couple of weeks in the internship before I was going to continue on to grad school. And I ended up, she was a sort of pillar of the community, 27 years old, and ran a ethnic musical group. And I realized that, you know, this is not just photos. This is audio. This is
sure
bigger than just photos. And so I built it. That was my first major multimedia project. And so I ended up following her around for 3 weeks until the group, the musical group that she ran, actually serenaded her through security at the airport. When she was getting on an airplane to go back to Columbia.
Oh, wow.
And that project was published in Flash, back when Flash was a thing that you publish things in. And so then I went and started my master's, and I decided I was getting my master's in something called convergence journalism, which is a great word. I feel like it's another very timely sort of, I don't want to say made up, but.
Right. Well, it was back when they didn't know what it was.
Yeah, like we need to do something.
We need to distinguish this from print, from broadcast, that it's not just computers or it's not just the internet. It's a lot of different pieces and we're not sure what it is. And it's convergence.
Exactly.
Because they kind of, and it's got a good buzz and it looks good on college paper work that they send out to people to try to get them to come to your school. We've got a convergence program.
Exactly.
Well, what does that mean? Well, it's a lot of things. So
when it came to, so that program actually taught photography. It taught broadcast, it taught radio. But it also taught some tech skills. And that was the side I was interested in. I wasn't that great at putting together stories in a broadcast fashion. My photography was good. I take better pictures than my husband, but it's not, award-winning. But I found that I really dug my heels into the tech side. And since there wasn't an established program, I actually taught myself during that time.
Taught yourself the programming?
Yes.
And what type of programs were you teaching yourself?
So at the time, I was basic, because I was working more on the graphics side, and I'd already had my feet in Flash. I started with Flash, HTML, and CSS for more front-end storytelling. And then I did my final project with the program on a contract at the Washington Post, and that is where I really dug into Python and Django.
Okay. And then those are things that you still use today?
Or yes.
Okay.
Well, Flash, not so much.
When I was in the interactive journalism program, another program that was sort of what does interactive journalism mean? One of our classes, one of our technical classes, our Flash class, started when they pretty much announced that, well, nobody's going to be doing Flash anymore, that we're going to stop doing it. So it was like, okay, well, what is our instructor going to teach us? So that's another long, sort of interesting story. You said something that sort of got me thinking about issues that I've sort of run into sometimes when I'm covering stories is when you cover something and you feel that the tools that you're using to tell your story are insufficient to the type of story that, I can write a text story, but, this is really, people should hear the words that this person is speaking. It should be audio, but, the visuals have so much power. I just did a piece for Federal News Radio about this artist at the Pentagon who was creating these incredible, he was a wounded warrior. He was doing sculpture through therapy, and the artwork was astounding. But at the same time, the way he was telling, his experience, for him it was very real, and he was very in the moment, and there wasn't a lot of artifice to the way he was presenting it. And I was like, man, there's a story in the way he's telling it too. And so it can be frustrating sometimes to go out there and just feel like, I just don't have the tools available to tell this the way it should be and all these sort of efforts. So going out and saying, hey, I need to sort of expand and find a bigger way of telling a story is something I think is pretty common to a lot of people sometimes.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And I think sometimes the solution in that when you don't have the tools is to find the allies to help you with that. And either help you sort of get you through that hump or work with you and do a partnership publish.
Mm-hmm. So now you taught yourself Flash and, how did that then take you to getting a career, the career that you have now?
Sure. So I had there was a position open for contract at the Washington Post. And in between on my master's, I also had an internship at Newsday.
Okay.
Doing sort of web producer and Flash stuff. And you can't see this on the audio, but I did cringe a little bit in my face.
Poor Flash. Once it was the superstar, and now it's, sort of, they put the cape over it.
Exactly.
James Brown has walked off the stage.
So when I was at the Post, I was brought on as a politics producer during the 2008 primaries.
Mm-hmm. A good time to be involved in data journalism.
Absolutely. Right? It was fantastic. We would, you know, track all the Democratic candidates. And it was great because every primary was like a mini election night. And so the thing I was working on when I walked in, it was January 2008. And I walked in about January 10th, just to put this in a context of, you know, the primaries are right there. I talked with the editors at that I was working with, Russ Walker and Jason Manning. Jason Manning, I think, right now is at Arizona State University teaching journalism. And we had a conversation about sort of what my project would be. And the conversation ended with, I'm going to work on this, work on displaying and parsing and displaying exit poll data online.
Interesting.
And I don't know if they know this, but interesting enough, I was like, great. And so I went back and they're like, you're going to go work with the development team. And I'm like, that's awesome. So I kind of did part managing the front page of the politics site and then working on this project. So I went back with the developers and I started coding and I started setting up my machine and coding. And I think it was like day four of that week of 4 days of me working on the project. And I came in on day four or five, and there was one day thrown away to all hands. I'll never forget it. And I walk into Jason Manning, and I said, you know, morning, Jason. I just wanted to check in. I'm going to go head over, work with the developers. He's like, great. You've been working on this a couple of days now. Do you think you'll have a prototype today? And I remember saying to Jason, yeah, so just give me a second. I'm gonna check on the status of things and I will be right back.
She went in the hall and screamed.
I went into the bathroom but basically did that.
Okay. They found me out.
But it was actually at my allies at the Post that helped me, the people who were my original mentors at the Post. That really helped me get through that hump of that first project in a real situation. And then from there, it was all downhill.
Oh, okay.
You can't. we got through that. So there was nothing beyond that that could scare me.
Oh, okay. Well, good. And so, that project went on to inform the campaign for that election. Did you do a lot of similar sort of projects in different areas for the Post?
Sure. So I went, while I was there, for 6 months and then my contract ended and I spent about a year in Burlington, Vermont, and then I came back. So I was, I had like sort of two separate parts. And during those two parts, I'm speaking about it collectively, the work was a combination. A lot of it was politics based. There was a whole series called the Obama Accountability Project, which included it was a 4-series project. It included stuff like Obama's schedules, Obama's speeches. We'd actually like do natural language processing. Obama's promises, actually looking at, you know, what kind of promises did he make and did he fulfill them? It also included sort of picking up on the work, a little bit of the work that Derek Willis, who's now at the New York Times, did with the congressional votes. But it also included stuff for local news and sports. I built out the NCAA bracket for the Post.
Uh-huh.
And I know nothing about the NCAA. Let's just say that.
64 teams.
Exactly.
Enter one exits. Are there particular data stories that you've written that you've been part of that you thought have been really sort of emblematic of what you can do and how to tell a story?
Sure. I think so. A lot of the projects that I'd mentioned had sort of been standalone. But I think one of the strongest that has been sort of standalone graphic or data plus story was Top Secret America. Are you familiar with that project?
Yeah. Okay.
Because it was great. It was writers. It was the graphics and the data and the story all coming together in a multi-format process. And I think that was a really great example of that.
So Top Secret America was sort of this project that looked at the contracting community and that sort of relationship with the way they work with the federal government. Could you sort of talk about the different elements of that and how you were able to contribute to it?
Sure. The data is set up so it divides it by agency, but also by service. So you might have something like office and admin services, and you might also have like IT services, and then it goes through and separates each of those by the agency. So how many of those agencies are requiring that service?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was great because we could provide a visual for that overlap of services. And so most of my work, though, was on the back end,
uh-huh.
working with sort of how to structure and how to provide the data on the front end.
Okay.
And interesting enough, this project was created in sort of more of a manual data collection process. And because of the nature of the content, we weren't able to see the content. So we were building out a database for something that we only had mock samples of.
Okay.
Which means that we didn't know what we were building for. Somebody would just say, it's going to look like this.
Uh-huh.
But we have no idea that it's really going to look like that.
Did you have... Well, then when the data appeared, what form did it come in? Was it just stuff that you were able to code in? Was it just, you know?
So it was an Excel or CSV.
Okay.
Where folks had been sort of collecting the data, and we were able to import it. The problem was with data that's sort of manually collected like that,
mm-hmm.
No matter what happens, because there's no constraints on the form,
right?
You might get something like 20 for let's say for organization size, you might get something like 20-40 or less than 10,
right?
And these things all mean different things.
There's no common lexicon for the way they're recording it agency to agency. They're all doing it their own way.
This was done by the reporters.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know.
They should have known better. They should have talked to the developers and say, hey, look, this is how we want it, blah, blah, blah.
We did have conversations, and they're great people. But, you know, in all honesty, they're human, right?
Right.
And, you know, making sure, you know, they're also the ones writing the stories. It's a team effort. It's a team effort in that they also have to write the stories and do the interviews. So we just took up the process of the data cleaning.
Okay. So when we talk about data journalism, what is it? Well, let me ask you that. What does data journalism mean to you?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Yes.
Okay. So data journalism to me is, I wasn't prepared for that. I mean, prepared, but I wasn't.
That's the type of hard-hitting questions we do on this podcast. maybe it is unfair, but I'm thinking of people who listen to this and are like, data, why do I care about data? Is that just, you know, that the court, you know, my city council is, you know, their records? Is it the government, you know, how often they collect taxes or hand out parking tickets or whatever. I mean,
sure.
You know, how do I incorporate that into, I mean, do I tell the story from the data end? Do I tell the story? Does the data then become, or does the data just become something that supports what I'm reporting? You know, how do I bring this all these pieces together?
So I think data journalism can be a combination of that. It can be, the data itself can be the story, because there are multiple stories in there, and you don't want to deny somebody the ability to explore it on their own. But then also, highlights from that data or summaries can be then used to illustrate stories.
Now, when you say that the data itself, there may be a story within that. I think we've had other guests in where they were talking about, you know, the data, you can't just rely on, oh, I'm going to get a chunk of data and there's just going to be a story. You need to figure out what story you want to tell, and then maybe how that data is going to inform that.
I think that's a correct observation. I also think that it's a combination of having an idea of where you're going to begin with, mm-hmm. or a topic that you're interested in. And then after that, also, you don't necessarily need to know the story before you go in, because I think sometimes that can close your mind to what the truth might actually be, because you're trying to find the information to make that story that you think is the story.
And maybe the data isn't going to support that. And so why, you know, and then you start cherry picking and pulling in things to support what you're doing, and you're not really telling the truth of what the data
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
So you need to be, on the one hand, it's the sort of the bitch goddess of data. It can be both good and bad for you.
What was the book? Was it like You Can Lie with Statistics or?
Yeah. Well,
you know,
I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. That book. It's the idea that you can use whatever numbers you want to use to tell the story that you want to tell.
Yeah. And we see that all the time in politics and in all types of things and in the way, you know, things are, you know, the way politicians can the two politicians can look at the same information and spin it completely different ways. So, you know. Anyway, which can be challenging for reporters and whatnot. So what advice would you give to somebody who maybe wants to become a data journalist or somebody? What advice would you give to somebody who maybe wants to become a data journalist and, you know, pick up these skills?
Sure. So I will say, first of all, when you get started, it's not easy. You're going to be very, very uncomfortable. But once you get past your first project, you've made it past the hardest part, like getting your computer set up and sort of getting started. My recommendation, first of all, is absolutely look into groups like the NICAR and IRE, National Institute of Computer Assisted Reporting, and Investigative Reporters and Editors. They have classes and trainings. They also have conferences. Another great resource is ONA. All these organizations have sort of resources that you can help and resources and community that you can help learn from. Also locally, there's a lot of Hacks and Hackers chapters, which is a group that sort of pairs up folks who are hacks and folks who are hackers. So you might come in as a hack and then over time, you become a hacker.
They give you a jacket or something.
That yeah, says you're now yeah. a hacker. And there are classes. There are classes in the community and locally.
Mm-hmm. Online classes as well.
Online classes, you know, especially what are they called? MOOCs.
MOOCs.
Yeah. So, I would say the number one recommendation I have, though, is to find a project that you want to do, and then to think about what are the little things that you need to do programmatically to learn to sort of stretch your skills. And maybe the first time, if you've never used something like Excel or you don't use it on a regular basis, maybe it's pulling a data set into Excel. But if you are already comfortable with that, maybe it's sort of automating some of these processes and learning something like Python. But to push yourself forward and to also give yourself a goal that's project-based. Otherwise, you don't know where you're going.
So what are your thoughts about, open data and how important it is for journalists, or even just citizens, that we have access to a lot of this data that the government collects, that A, we have access to it, and B, that we have access to it in a form that we can actually use to do something with?
So every time I go look at something like data.gov, or I'm looking at an agency website and, you know, I somehow made it to their sort of open data portal, which should be or most likely or usually is incorporated in data.gov. I'm constantly amazed by the crazy data sets I find. I think once recently I saw, it might have been a data set from 2012, but it was a data set of like sleep patterns of train operators. I mean, how cool would that be for a story if you started playing with that data, right? Yeah. There's just all these great data sets. And I think there's tons of opportunities to do stories on these things.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And we found, it's funny because the job that I'm in, I cover the federal government. You know, you work for the federal government. And one of the things that sometimes we'll be reading about or be researching or reporting on something where, there'll be a congressional hearing and somebody at one agency will say, well, yeah, we were sort of we wanted to do, you know, this, but it turns out that the data that we were collecting was in a completely different way than our office was doing it. And then this other agency we're supposed to be working at, they're doing it a completely different way. And just the idea of sort of standardizing the way that people collect and present data so that, you know, just that simple fact would make it so much easier for, for the operation of the government, but also certainly the operation of journalists being able to read that, or the public being able to have access to it.
Absolutely. And I think those standardizations are happening every day, just like we are not perfect as people, right? Technology happened in a way that was very quickly, and it's not like we all have perfect systems to store it, right? We do not all have the perfect skill sets, and we do not have perfect systems. And we cannot expect everything to be perfect. However, as time passes and the use cases and funding come up, you find more and more of this. So that's part of why I moved into government, was I saw the same journalism. I saw the same mission in journalism as I saw. I see the same mission in government that I saw in journalism, mm-hmm. in that empowering the American people and educating them and opening up. It's just sort of a layer further back.
Right. Now, and there are people who would say that you've crossed over to the other side, that you're, but actually I've talked to many people who work in government who have the same sort of enthusiasm that I see in journalists, that they want to serve the public and they want to bring information and make things better. And we've talked to a couple of people on the podcast who work for the government and have sort of made that change in their lives, because they were like, you know, hey, this is a lot of the skills that I have I can use to, you know, make, well, in your case, make data more accessible to people, and helping the government sort of make that data more accessible and things like that.
My first jump towards the federal government was after the Post. I took a job with CACI on a contract at the Library of Congress. Uh-huh. And I was working on a project called Chronicling America, which was an old newspaper archive. So it was still newspapers, just really old ones. And what I observed too was that librarians are no different than journalists, other than, and this is going to be a gross summary, and people are probably going to hate me for this, but for me, journalists were like, we want to know what happened in the last 5 minutes,
right?
Up to 5 minutes ago to now, and librarians are like, if it's not 6 months old,
yeah, we don't really care.
And yeah, exactly. And the individuals, and then we as the general population are the space in between.
Yeah, no, and I've talked to people who work at the archives or work at the Smithsonian, and it's so funny that they see that they have a lot of the same mission as journalists, that they're trying to get information out to the public, and they're actually embracing a lot of the same technologies, putting stuff up on the web so that people can, access it, getting information out there so that people can sort of inform Wikipedia articles and things like that. So just sort of create the larger mass of information for the public to access.
I don't know if there was a whole website as much as a Twitter account for edits of Wikipedia from Capitol Hill?
No.
Oh,
I don't remember that. So tell me about this. This sounds funny.
This is pretty fantastic. There was a the group I was with at the Library of Congress, there was one gentleman after I went on my way, who created I don't know if there was a site behind it as much as a Twitter account, but a way for a way that looks at the IP addresses of edits. And just to explain, IP address is basically like your location mm-hmm. on the internet.
It's how Big Brother can follow you.
Yeah. And so in his personal time, he looked at IP addresses that edits on Wikipedia that were happening from IPs that were associated with Capitol Hill or Congress.
Interesting.
And then he started posting them as tweets. on a Twitter account, and there was a couple of other people who picked up his code and implemented it for their own countries.
Interesting.
So he kind of like grew up overnight. It just took off overnight. And it was a very small idea, but great insight to see how folks on Capitol Hill were editing articles on Wikipedia
to reflect whatever particular thing was they wanted to reflect.
I assume that would be the case. I mean,
I'm sure that they were just editing spelling errors and things like that. There was no nefarious. I'm sure it was all above board and whatnot.
I love that project. You know, it was a side project that somebody did. Who you don't have to be a journalist to do this.
No, you can mess with people all the time using programming and hacking and data, and just put it up on Twitter and let Twitter run everything. What do you see? What are your hopes going forward about data journalism, about the way that we're better informing our stories with by using data?
So I feel that more and more data is going to become available, and this is a skill set that everyone needs to learn. I mean, not just in journalism, but beyond. You think about, let's say, a biology major, pre-med major, who was studied 5 years ago, and one who studies now, who might have a requirement for a programming class to be able to do data analysis.
You'd think a lot of people at colleges would be that this would be part of what they were doing, especially if they were doing research of some sort. That, you know, hey, this is better, helps me better access material, but also present it and spread what I'm doing.
And speaking to that point, on the research side, journalists are researchers. And they're researchers who are able to take information, digest it, and communicate it in a way that makes it easier for everyone to understand who might not be authority in the topic.
Yeah.
So, in that way, they are researchers. Another question, though, is that they can. Another question that journalists can answer by knowing data journalism is to say, instead of taking a research study that somebody just did, or data that they processed, that they can go back and actually look at that, like ask for their data, ask for their code, and say, how did you come to this conclusion, and have a better understanding of it as opposed to just accepting it?
You know, it's interesting. Some of the conversations that I really like having on this podcast are sort of imagining the way that the newsroom is sort of changing. That, you know, there was this sort of idea that reporters would become these jack of all trades who would, you know, they would shoot, they would record, they would write, they would program, they would do all this stuff. And then, you know, something you said about, you know, working with developers in a newsroom, I think it is important that every journalist understand, you know, maybe they're not going to be super programmers, but that they understand the needs of programmers in the way that they tell their stories, and maybe, you know, sort of inform their way of going out and, you know, when they're gathering information, when they're interviewing people, and thinking about how they're going to present it, and then how they're going to work with developers or program themselves. So what do you see is happening in the newsroom these days with how the role of the developer or the programmer, the reporter are sort of changing?
Sure. I think often now people are having conversations earlier, and often the reporters are the ones who are closest to the content. And they might come across something and not recognize its value from a programmatic standpoint. And so I think what's happening now is reporters are understanding that earlier. So like you said, you don't necessarily have to be an expert, but you have to have an understanding of sort of what a developer or data or the person who's working with the data might need. In 2008, Hillary Clinton's White House schedules came out.
Right.
It was supposed to be 11,000 pages, and it turned out to be 17,000 pages that were PDFs, and they were images. And so this is kind of like, so you've had a PDF before where you can take your mouse and select the text and copy it and paste it, right? So when a PDF is an image, it means that you can't select it and copy it. It's like somebody printed it out, scanned it, maybe turned it a little bit, and then saved all those images together.
Right.
And so it was 17,000 pages of
They're helping you out by putting them in as images. That's what they're doing.
Now, in all honesty, I don't think somebody purposefully did this. I just think it was the easiest way to release
sure,
it.
Sure.
And so when that came across my table, while I had at that point some knowledge, I understood that there is a gold mine in the 17,000 pages. I don't understand. At that point, I didn't understand what to do with it.
Right.
And this was...
You make a photo gallery.
And so I took that to folks who had more understanding. And overnight, using Amazon Web Services, they were able to split a process over many machines, which took those images and converted it to text and then turned it into a searchable database.
Wow.
And so, you know, at that point, I mean, now I can actually do that, but... At that point, it was really exciting because I knew enough to know that this was something.
Right.
And that's the first step.
Right. We had I think Brian Bowers in and a couple other people who were talking about the same sort of thing is, you know, that relationship between the reporter and the data person, the programmer, who can, it's a two-way street. You're helping each other sort of break down the importance of it. And the developer, the programmer is going to have a different perspective about maybe, hey, you know, I can take this up to the next level. Let's do this. So now I think was the Hillary Clinton thing? Was that something you told at the PBS Media Shift?
Yes.
I thought, yeah, that was.
Because that was an early story where it was, I was very humbled by it to be able to work on that project, but mm-hmm. not to be able to. Not necessarily have the skills and not be in the control that I am today over data.
Okay. Well, what's next for you, young lady? You're still at GSA, and what type of projects would you be working on in the future?
I don't know that I've ever planned. I know currently I'm working on my PhD.
Oh, cool.
In computational social science. Which is computer science and social science mixed together.
And then the Holy Union.
Exactly. So so that's that might take me down to my next adventure.
Cool.
I'm also currently working on a book for O'Reilly.
Oh, wow.
Which is tentatively called Data Wrangling.
Oh.
So it's basically taking folks who might have skills in, let's say, Excel or basic data analysis skills and teaching them Python and to be able to a point where they're able to publish something on the web and create like a summary story.
Oh, neat.
So that's one of my projects. And, you know, of course, there's my day job at GSA, which brings me. Yeah.
Innovating takes a lot of time, a lot of brain power, I would imagine.
Where my technical title is innovation specialist.
Innovation specialist. You specialize in innovation. Can I ask you about the Presidential Fellows?
Sure.
About now, this is a program that they it didn't start with the Obama administration, I don't think, or did it?
I think it did.
I didn't think it did. Okay, they bring in innovative people from lots of different areas. They give them some money, and did you get to choose your own sort of this is what I want to focus on, or was it more, how did that work?
So when I submitted my application,
complete lack of preparation, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. When I submitted my application, there was a couple of different areas that you could choose from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through and I remember it cause I was at PyCon and, some of my friends wanted to go out and I was the one submitting my application.
I would imagine that's a Python convention, a program,
yes.
As not a
yes.
not a Pi convention.
No,
which is
although that would be enjoyable too.
Okay, yes. but so
I remember some of my friends were going out or coding together or something, and I was like, no, guys, I got to stay in and do this thing I need to work on because it was the deadline. And
yes. Yeah, why do it sooner? Why do it before you go to this conference?
Isn't that what every journalist does? Or former journalist. So I was working on the application, and you had to The application was made such to be to have a low barrier. So it wasn't like your traditional like USA Jobs application, but it was very low barrier. And there were sort of topic areas that you could choose. And then you had to sort of write, I don't know, some, I'm probably going to be have the wrong word count, but like, you know, 400 characters or 400 words or something.
Sure.
It wasn't 400 words. It was like, it was on the character side.
Okay.
And about like sort of how your work or why you're interested in that topic. And one of the topics I had selected was disaster response and recovery.
Oh, wow.
During the process, I actually had, I don't know how I, you know, the process is a mystery to me, but through the, somehow I ended up with three of the projects reaching out to me. So then I ended up with a choice between two, which was with a project doing disaster response and recovery or the project with the Department of Education.
Oh, wow.
And I really felt the disaster response and recovery mission.
Right.
But it was like, you know, it was like, oh, do I take the good thing or do I take the good thing?
Yeah.
You know,
it's nice to have choices.
It was a great position to be in. It was amazing. And so I ended up working on a project with FEMA and working to sort of pre-prepare tools in the event of a disaster.
Okay. Now, when you say tools, what type of tools are we talking about?
One of the tools I worked on was called GeoQ. And GeoQ was a project currently open source on GitHub, which is a website where you can find code that's open. GeoQ was a project that was based in the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and FEMA wanted to be able to access it and to be able to have more people contribute to the project. So when I identified this, we ended up rewriting it and expanding it and open sourcing it so that we can, so they could work collaboratively on it.
Okay.
And the project GeoQ is basically an open source mapping workflow tool. So taking objects of information most easily illustrated by images. So if you take images from a variety of sources, and some of those could be public sources like, you know, Twitter. Imagine Twitter after disaster, and, you know, Flickr, so on and so forth, but also sources that the government might be using, like the Civil Air Patrol. And the Civil Air Patrol is retired airline pilots who are basically flying over a disaster area to assess the damages with, you know, a camera out the window going click, 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 and taking all that information and being able to say, okay, this area has been hard hit. We can, you know, start issuing recovery funds for this area. You can also use the information for something like situational awareness to say that, you know, this, if you start tracking road outages or blockages, you can say, okay, these three routes are out. So we need to send ambulances and fire trucks around. It might take 20 extra minutes, but they're not wasting their time finding out all these areas are blocked.
So you're sort of marrying the images that you get with the geospatial information so that and adding it to a map or whatever to so that people can utilize it.
Yes. Yes. Cool. And this tool is such that it's currently, since it's on currently on GitHub, it's also a tool that, you know, folks in journalism could use. Granted, it takes a little bit of setup. It's not, you know. It's not like you visit a website and it's there.
It's not an app you get from the iTunes store.
Exactly. I think it might have already been done, but they've I think NGA worked on creating setup scripts so you can actually create a machine like off of AWS or Rackspace or some other service, and it'll set up the whole machine for you and get the application running, and then it has some sample data sets that you can pull in. And if you go to try to do this and it's not working for you, if you file a ticket, they're very responsive and attentive to any, you know, issues you might be having because they want people to use it. So, but it's a great, like, you know, you can, like I said, put objects of information. So we've been talking about images, but you could also do video. You could also do, let's say, tweets. and then use it to classify without images, use it to classify the information in a, I don't know, like, let's say, you know, is this a positive or negative tweet? Mm-hmm. Right. And then you just mark it as positive. Right. And that's the value you track. So it doesn't necessarily have to be images, but then you can associate, let's say, you know, positive or negative values with a certain geographical area.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff. Jackie, thanks for coming in. This has been fun. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. I really enjoyed being here.
Good.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.